The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Is COVID-19 a bioweapon? Now, the debate hasn't really gone there yet, but why not? If the virus leaked out of the Wuhan lab, it could do it in two ways, either accidentally or deliberately. So that's what I'm going to explore today. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
Needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
Is COVID-19 a bioweapon? Is it a biological weapon deliberately released by the Chinese government and the Chinese Communist Party in order to achieve its global objectives? Now, the debate hasn't really gone there, but I think it needs to. Why not? If the virus leaked out of the Wuhan lab, there are kind of two ways that could happen. The first one, of course, is an accidental leak. Oops, the virus got out. But the other is they wanted the virus to get out. And that cannot be written off without looking into it. That's what I'm calling for. I'm going to lay out sort of a theory of how and why it could have happened and then ask, are we going to investigate this? Now, right early in 2020, now this is about almost a year and a half ago, Debbie and I were on a long plane flight from California, I believe, to Texas after doing a speaking event. And Debbie was kind of on the Wi-Fi and she said, hey, take a look at this. And she showed me a video. And this was really before the lockdowns, before the global awareness of COVID. But it was a scene in China, and you saw a group of Chinese people in full hazmat suits. And they were going into the apartments of Chinese families and dragging people out by force. Those people were screaming, please, please. They were, one guy was holding on to one leg, another guy to another leg. They were pulling these people out and tossing them into vans. And then you would see these same Chinese guys in hazmat suits walking through the streets with huge, it seemed like leaf blowers, but they were fumigating the streets. It was an eerie scene. It's a scene out of Apocalypse Now. And this Debbie was like discombobulated and disturbed by this. And she goes, what's going on? This is not normal. And I agreed, but I didn't really make too much of it. But I'm thinking about that scene, one of the most, to me, arresting images of COVID in retrospect, because it almost seems like at a time when the world didn't know much about COVID, knew about it, but didn't know much about it. There was no talk at that time of a global pandemic. It seems like the Chinese knew what they had on their hands. They knew what they were dealing with. And this, of course, raises the question, was this part of something that they orchestrated or planned? Now, when I look at the all the talk surrounding the investigations of the origin of COVID-19 now, I see that it seems to think that there are two possibilities. Either this emerged naturally out of a wet market. I've been saying meat market. I'm sorry. I meant wet market in Wuhan. Or it leaked accidentally out of the Wuhan lab. Those are the two sort of options. Here is Mike Ryan. He's the World Health Organization director of the emergency program. I'm quoting him. There are competing theories. The virus jumped from animals, possibly starting with bats, to humans, or it escaped from a laboratory in Wuhan, China. And here is the important article I've cited before by the two leading scientists, Stephen Kay and Richard Mueller, from the Wall Street Journal. The science suggests a Wuhan lab leak. And think of that title, The Science Suggests a Wuhan Lab Leak. They go on to point out that the virus looks to be man-made, but they seem to assume that if it was man-made, it is a leak. In other words, it came out inadvertently. They don't even seem to consider the possibility that this could have been done deliberately. Now, why do people make deadly viruses? Well, I can think of three reasons. One, they're doing it to find cures for disease. Two, they're doing it because they can, out of, you may say, the kind of idle scientific curiosity that proverbially killed the cat. We can do it, so let's do it. We'll worry about the risks later. Or three, as a bioweapon. Now, the Chinese have had, no one denies, a biological weapons program. In fact, they've had one since the mid-1980s. The New York Times did an article in 1993 talking about how China is building up its bioweapons program, a highly clandestine program initiated by the Communist Party and its leadership. So we have to look at the two competing theories. Either it was an accidental leak or it was a bioweapon. Now, it seems to me that the best argument for a leak is the idea that the virus got out in Wuhan. That would seem to suggest a leak. Why? Because if it were really deliberate, if it was a bioweapon, why release it in your own country? It would seem to me the Chinese would be more likely to say, hey, listen, let's take this over and release it in the Netherlands. It'll get out over there and spread from there. It'll be more difficult to trace to us. But I think that this way of thinking, although it seems plausible, is actually a little bit naive. Why? Because it now turns out that you can look at the virus itself and see inside of the genetic code of the virus a signature that suggests it's man-made. So the Chinese, if this were a bioweapon, would know this. And they would know that if they release it in the Netherlands, people would say, whoa, wait a minute, this was a man-made virus. Well, who's making these deadly viruses? The leading place in the world, Wuhan, China. So in other words, then you would know it was released deliberately. Now, here's the advantage of having it released in Wuhan from the Chinese point of view. You can make a deliberate release of the virus look like a leak. If the virus got out in Wuhan, if it kills a bunch of Chinese, people are going to say, well, gee, obviously it leaked out. There was some kind of negligence. So even though China is responsible, it's one thing to be responsible for negligence. It's a whole other thing to be responsible for something deliberate. Now, here's the point. It's a little hard for many people to believe. In fact, Fauci said recently, he goes, the Chinese have every interest in cooperating. They have every interest in disclosing what happened here. He's assuming that they wouldn't dream of releasing this virus deliberately. But I think that is, you can say, Fauci naivete, Fauci stupidity. Why? Because communist governments have never hesitated to kill a whole bunch of their own people. They mainly kill their own people. Even if you look at the socialist government in Nazi Germany, the National Socialists, and you think of the Jews, yeah, the Jews were seen by Hitler as not, you know, they're aliens, but they were Germans. Stalin killed millions of his own people, millions of Russians. Mao killed millions of Chinese. So this idea that Chinese would never dream of killing some of their own people. They certainly would if their leadership was inoculated, if their leadership had the vaccine in advance, if their leadership had a way of protecting them. That's who they care about. This was also true in the Soviet Union. They cared about their own inner circle, their own nomenclatura. They didn't care about anyone else. It would seem to me that there are three good reasons for the Chinese to want to use COVID-19 as a bioweapon. If they could. One, to get rid of Trump. Trump was a menace as far as the Chinese were concerned. Look at the timing of the virus. It was almost like a political and scientific nuclear bomb dropped in the middle of the 2020 election year. Two, to deliver a body blow to the world economy, and particularly to the U.S. economy. The U.S. has been essentially the world's superpower, but think of what happens if the U.S. is essentially blown up from within, and if the Chinese are able to take a blow but recover much more quickly. That is, in fact, what has been the case. And the third is, hey, to thin out the Chinese population. The Chinese don't exactly have a shortage of people. This is a virus that disproportionately affects old people who would otherwise be wards of the state. So if you think this kind of diabolical reasoning is impossible for a socialist government, impossible for a communist party, Well, it's time to learn a little bit of history. So I'm happy to report, guys, that the Dinesh book and movie giveaway to support Mike Lindell is going great. We need to support Mike. He's a guy who shows great courage in speaking up for his faith and his ideas, and he's paid a high price for it. Good news is he makes great products, and I want to make it even easier for you to get these products. So here's the deal. I haven't even really told Mike about it, but you go all out. You buy $250 or $500 or $1,000 of MyPillow merchandise. Now, this is not that hard to do. Lindell has more than 100 great products, from the classic premium pillows, which you got to try, to the Giza Dream bed sheets, to the MyPillow robes, the MyPillow mattress topper, the MyPillow dog beds. The list goes on. Now, here's the fun part. If you spend $250 or more, I'll send you a copy of one of my recent books, one of my favorites, personally autographed to you. If you spend $500, you get two signed books plus two of my movies. And if you spend $1,000, sort of you get the grand prize. Four signed books, four movies, a mini Dinesh collection. So let's get behind Mike. Let's show what we can do for him and get some great products and some great books and movies into the bargain. Here's how you do it. Call 800-876-0227 or go to MyPillow.com and use promo code Dinesh. Now, what else do you have to do to get the books and movies? Well, nothing. I'm going to get the info from the MyPillow guys. I've got an insider there who gives me the scoop. Even Mike doesn't know about it. This way I can send the books to the same address that you use for your merchandise. Now, the offer ends July 4th. Again, the number to call, 800-876-0227, or go to MyPillow.com to get the discounts, to get the books and movies. You got to use promo code D-I-N-E-S-H, Dinesh. In trying to think about whether COVID-19 is a virus accidentally released from the Wuhan lab or deliberately released as part of a bioweapon, we have to keep in mind two sayings, one by Machiavelli and one by Sun Tzu. Machiavelli says that if you have an enemy and the enemy makes an obvious blunder, always suspect a deception. Why? Because the blunder is likely to be a ruse that draws you into thinking, oh, these guys are so stupid. But in fact, they've thought of it. This is actually part of their plan. Sun Tzu says something in his Art of War that's also relevant here. He goes, I'm now quoting him, if one party is at war with another and the other party does not realize it is war, the party that knows it is war almost always has the advantage and wins the war. So apply this now to our situation. We're investigating, did COVID-19 come out from a market in Wuhan, or did it come out accidentally? We're not even, it seems, seriously looking at, was this a bioweapon? Now, the former FDA commissioner, Scott Gottlieb, said that there have been six previous leaks out of Wuhan. And that might seem to support the idea, well, gee, this is also a leak. This is number seven. But for the Chinese government, with all its centralized control, don't you think that after these six leaks, they'd be saying, hey, listen, we can't let this happen again, not to mention with the most lethal viruses that we're cooking up here. So the fact that this happens a seventh time cuts both ways. It could be accidental, but it could also be deliberate. Now, I want to look at some very specific clues. I want to begin with Bat Lady. This is the woman who is Zheng Li, who supervised the Chinese Wuhan lab program. And this is someone who seems very sophisticated. She speaks multiple languages. She shows up at World Health Organization events. But there's no question that she is actually part of the Chinese regime. She doesn't have control over how this research is used. Who does? Well, Xi Jinping, the Chinese government does. They tell her what to do. This is communism, remember? Now, it's also significant that Bat Lady took down, in September of 2019, her whole database, which shows the research. That this database was online, but it's all been taken down. And why? Interestingly, when the World Health Organization showed up, they never even asked to see the database. They knew about it. But Peter Daszak, who was this is a gain-of-function researcher in America, who seems to be in bed with the Chinese, this guy goes, well, we didn't even really ask for the database. We didn't even demand it. Now, the Chinese, going back to the 80s and 1990s, have had a sophisticated bioweapons program. They talk openly about the cooperation between their health sectors and their civilian sectors generally and their military. Xi Jinping uses the phrase biosecurity to refer to this exact cooperation. In the late 1990s, there were two guys, Chao Lang and Wang Changshui, two officers of the Chinese military, who published a book called Unrestricted Warfare. And in this book, they talked about biological weapons. And I'm quoting them now. It cannot be denied that man-made earthquakes, tsunamis, weather disasters, or subsonic waves, and new biological and chemical weapons all constitute new concept weapons whose goal is to kill and destroy, and which are related to strategy, to overall military strategy. Now, the U.S. government is aware of the involvement of the Chinese military in the Wuhan lab. In fact, Christopher Ford, the Undersecretary for Arms Control and Security, is quoted in Vanity Fair as saying, inside of the U.S. government, he goes, you know, he's not worried about the fact that the Chinese military is involved with Wuhan research because he says, after all, quote, the U.S. Army has been involved in virus research in the United States. So he seems to think that we do it too, they do it. What's really the big deal? Now, when Mike Pompeo and the State Department were investigating what was going on in China, they found that they found, very interestingly, a study that goes back to April of 2020. 11 of its 23 co-authors worked for the Academy of Military Medical Sciences in China. In other words, it was really clear that there is now direct collaboration between the Chinese military and the Wuhan lab. I want to quote from one of the works produced by this collaboration. This is a book called The Unnatural Origin of SARS and New Species of Man-Made Viruses as Genetic Bioweapons. This is something, by the way, that the NSC under Trump had in their possession. They had this book, they had the research, and it turns out that it was written by a team of 18 authors and editors, 11 of whom worked at China's Air Force Medical University. So this is a military collaboration, if not a military operation. I want to quote a really chilling passage from this book. Quote, bioweapon aerosol attacks are best conducted during dawn, dusk, night, or cloudy weather because ultraviolet rays can damage the pathogens. In other words, if you release these pathogens at any other time, the ultraviolet rays might kill them, might reduce the lethality of the virus. And then the study cites, quote, collateral benefits, saying that a sudden surge of hospitalizations would cause the healthcare systems to collapse. So if you have an enemy, you release a bioweapon, and it has an immediate effect, metastasizing effect, this would cause a breakdown of the healthcare systems in the West. Now, this has been reported in Australian newspapers, specifically the Australians, and the Chinese have been trying to dismiss this book and its implications. One final clue I want to mention, and that is that I read this in the Daily Mail out of London. It says, Chinese military scientist filed a patent for COVID-19 vaccine before the virus was declared a global pandemic. And this is a military scientist who has worked in, quote, close collaboration with Batwoman at the Wuhan Institute. So a Chinese military scientist reportedly filed a patent for a vaccine. This guy's name is Yusen Zhu. He worked for the People's Liberation Army. He filed the paperwork in February of 2020. Think about this. In February of 2020, before the vaccine was, quote, out, before we were locking down, which that was in March of 2020, here's a guy filing a patent, not for research onto the virus, for a cure, a patent for the vaccine. And this, of course, raises the question, did the Chinese Communist Party already have a vaccine? Think about it. If it was a biological weapon, they would obviously have said to the Wuhan lab, listen, guys, make some deadly viruses, but make sure you also find the cure, find the vaccine, and give us the vaccine so that we, the Communist Party elite, can take the vaccine before the virus even gets out. Now, none of this, even taken together, alarming as it is dispositive. It doesn't prove the case, but these are clues. These are clues that suggest that you cannot write out of hand and just kind of dismiss the idea of a bioweapon. It's a real possibility. It urgently needs to be investigated. In a time of economic uncertainty and actually economic irresponsibility, we need to do what we can to protect our finances. So think about what's going on now. Consumer prices up by 4.2%, the highest bump since 2008. We're seeing higher fuel prices, higher food prices, higher construction costs, housing prices. So inflation isn't just kind of on the way, it's here. So have you protected your savings, your investments? If you haven't yet diversified a portion into precious metals, the answer, I'm afraid, is no. And now for years, even decades, I never invested in gold, only the stock market. But now I'm really worried about these Biden people, no sense of fiscal responsibility. So listen, if all your investments are tied to greenbacks, you're sitting on a bit of a ticking time bomb. You need to invest a portion of your savings into gold and silver. Birch Gold Group is who you should deal with. These are the guys I buy from. These are the people you can trust to convert an IRA or eligible 401k into an IRA backed by gold and silver. Now, through a little-known tax loophole, you're allowed to convert your retirement savings tied to the stock market into an IRA backed by precious metals. It's your hedge against inflation. Text Dinesh to 484848 for your free information kit on precious metals IRAs or to speak with a Birch Gold representative today. They've got 10,000 customers, an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, and countless five-star reviews. They can help you, too. Text Dinesh to 484848 and invest in gold with Birch Gold before it's too late. With the Democrats pushing in bad directions on just about every front, there is, in fact, there has been now for some time, a kind of underground discussion about should the conservatives secede? Should the conservatives consider some form of secession? Secession from their America, from the America they're trying to foist and force upon us. But there's a really interesting article in American Greatness. It's written by Jeremy Carl. It's called The New Secession Crisis. And it makes the remarkable point that we don't really need to secede from them. They are seceding from America. They're seceding from the country as we have known it, from the country as we have collectively built it. I want to read the kind of significant line from the article. It says, the growing and energetic majority of Democratic leaders, this is not some small faction, this is one of the major two parties in the country, have already seceded from America, from its culture, its history, its government, and its institutions. And this is a startling claim. And but Jeremy Carl, the writer, brings up a pretty impressive array of evidence to show that they have, in fact, done this. He says that these are people who have gone to war with our culture. Look at all the pulling down of monuments. They've gone to war with our history, our traditions, our system of government. Everything that has attracted people to America and bound Americans together in the past, that is now the target of the left. Let's look at some examples. Number one, they've occupied our nation's capital with thousands of troops as if the American people themselves were some kind of a foreign foe. They've done this on the pretext of insurgency, but the simple truth of it is they have militarized the U.S. Capitol. Two, they have nullified our immigration laws, laws that were passed through the normal process. They've essentially nullified them by refusing to enforce them. Left-wing judges during the Trump years erected one procedural roadblock after another. Essentially, let's torpedo this Trump policy and buy time. And even if it's ultimately overturned, the policy won't be able to be enforced for the majority of the Trump years. They've tried to neuter the Second Amendment, and they're still trying to do that. They have imposed regimes of censorship with Democratic politicians working in cahoots with and cheering on these big tech censors to essentially make the First Amendment or free speech virtually a dead letter in this country. They have They have turned the media into a propaganda arm of the Democratic Party. So a media in terms of a critical check on government is become a non-entity. We just don't have one. And when there are important stories like the Hunter Biden story before the election, they just simply collectively censor it. They've used the instruments of the state, the FBI, the IRS, to go after opponents. They've tried to sort of manipulate the election process, violating all kinds of explicit state laws, manipulating debates and rules, sending in armies of lawyers to tie things up with litigation. They have unleashed asymmetric street violence. Basically, for them, violence is speech. And for us, in their view, speech is violence. So they censor hate speech as if it amounts to violence, or whatever they categorize as hate speech. Meanwhile, they unleash real violence on the street and excuse it, defend it. And in the case of Kamala Harris, they raise bail money for it. They've corrupted our jury system, as we saw in the Derek Chauvin trial. They've locked us down in our homes under the pretext of COVID. They're now going after the filibuster. They're trying to pack the Supreme Court. Now, I realize there are a couple of moderate Democrats, maybe Kristen Sinema, maybe Joe Manchin, that stand in their way. But think about it. Does the fate of the country hang in the balance of these two? Maybe I will, maybe I won't Democrats? Is that what it's come down to? So what Jeremy Carl is saying is we've got to sort of realize we're in kind of a serious situation, not all that different from the one that Lincoln faced at Fort Sumter, which is to say that one party, and in 1860, it was the Democratic Party, both in the North and the South, that was giving support to the idea of breaking the country in two. In fact, Northern Democrats often said, yeah, let's just work out something with the South, quote, let our erring sisters depart. And now, says Jeremy Carl, we've got to recognize we're facing an assault from an ideological movement, the left, and the Democratic Party that just doesn't believe in America. They don't believe in our Constitution. They're perfectly willing to set, they'll appeal to it when it's convenient, but they're happy to set it aside when it's not. They don't believe in our police. They are trying to corrupt our military. And ultimately, they're trying to impose a tyrannical regime on us. We've got to make sure that we fully take on board the seriousness of the situation so we can protect our liberties and free ourselves from this tyrannical regime. If you're thinking of replacing your carpets due to pet stains and odors, I've got the solution for you, Genesis 950. Now, this product has amazing reviews. It works beautifully. With water, it breaks down the bonds of stains and odors so they are gone for good. Its antibacterial component removes pet odors from carpet and padding. It can be used in a carpet cleaning machine, and it's green, so it's completely safe for your family and pets. Genesis 950, made in America. 1 gallon of industrial strength Genesis 950 makes up to 7 gallons of cleaner. But by the way, Genesis 950 is also great for bathrooms, for floors, upholstery, and grease stains. Debbie uses it to clean the entire kitchen, and when I got chocolate on my pants and on the couch, Genesis 950 took it right off. Genesis 950 has great customer service. Order 1 gallon direct at genesis950.com to receive a free spray bottle, free shipping, and a $10 coupon code using the code Dinesh. That's genesis950.com. Coupon only available for 1 gallon purchase. Genesis 950, it's much cheaper than replacing your carpets or your pants, or your couch. I'm really happy to welcome to the podcast Seth Baron. Seth is the managing editor of The American Mind, a publication of the Claremont Institute. He's also a writer for City Journal, which is published by the Manhattan Institute. He's an inveterate New Yorker, and he's written an important book, which is called The Last Days of New York. Seth, welcome to the podcast. I lived in New York for 2 years, really 2010 to 2012. And New York appeared at that time to be kind of on the edge of a bit of a precipice. But by which I mean that it had come off the glory days of the Giuliani years with Bill Bratton as the police commissioner and then Bloomberg. But something seemed to be going wrong with New York. And then, of course, later we had COVID. Tell us what you think was the tipping point, if there was one, for New York, or have we had a gradually building catastrophe? What's your diagnosis?
Well, I would say that Bill de Blasio came to power at the end of 2013, but it wasn't just him. There was a whole set of progressive politicians, a whole coterie of what I call the progressive ascendancy, who rose to power at the same time. And they had a pretty radical agenda for changing New York and going in a different direction from where it had been. They wanted to end certain police practices that they thought were racist and overbearing. And more important, or as importantly, they sought to remove wealth inequality and income inequality. They had sort of a socialistic plan to eliminate the gap between what de Blasio called the tale of two cities, you know, the haves and the have-nots. You know, he also wanted to change the way housing worked, education, homelessness. He had a very grand project. And, you know, this sort of went the way a lot of socialist revolutions go. It didn't work out as they'd wanted.
Now, you said that they wanted to change the way things were in New York. Now, New York has been, of course, New York City in Democratic hands for a long time. New York State, as I understand it, at least in the past, had a certain kind of equilibrium between the liberal or Democratic power of the city versus the Republican, at least tempering influence of upstate New York. Was there some kind of fundamental shift in which the left, in a sense, got the hold, not only the whole city, but they got control, it seems, of the whole state. How did that occur?
Well, remember, 30 years ago, Giuliani was elected, and he was a Republican, but, you know, sort of what we used to call like a Rockefeller Republican. He's, you know, socially fairly liberal, but good on fiscal stuff and very pro law and order. 30 years ago, though, New York was a different city. Demographically, morally, politically. Since then, and then Giuliani ruled for 8 years, and under him, crime took a huge dip down. He brought Bill Bratton in as the police commissioner, and they instituted, you know, broken window policing, which isn't as harsh as people try to make it sound. It's really just the idea being that crime breeds in a condition of disorder. So if you establish public order and safe streets, everything follows from that. After Giuliani, Bloomberg came in. He had a challenging first year or two because of 9/11, but he continued to drive crime down with pretty active policing. De Blasio came in and reversed a lot of those policing practices. And we didn't see an immediate spike in crime, but the stage was set. And, you know, many of us predicted that there would eventually be an increase in violent crime. And indeed, there has been.
And not just crime, because de Blasio, of course, said notoriously that there is plenty of money. It's just in the wrong hands. And I take this to be kind of a socialist mantra, because they're assuming when they say that wealth needs to be redistributed, that there was some pre-existing distribution. So in other words, that people don't earn money. They don't create wealth by making new businesses and so on. But rather, there's some original distribution. It's unjust, and therefore one can blueprint or pre-plan a kind of more ideal distribution. Is this the kind of demented philosophy that's driving? I mean, New York, of course, has been a city creating great wealth and symbolizing great wealth. And are these people, did these people set to sort of take down that system?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm so glad you brought up that quote, which he devised for his presidential campaign as a kind of, you know, punchline that was supposed to get a lot of applause. It didn't really work. But yes, absolutely. He's been a redistributionist since the beginning. A few years ago, he said, if I had my druthers, I would be in control of every square inch of real estate in New York City and decide what it was for and who got to live there and all of that. You know, even things like very recently, he said that screening for entry to sixth grade, like middle school screening, he said, help me eliminate this and help me redistribute wealth. This is everything is cast in terms of redistribution of wealth. And in regard to this idea that it's rectification of a purer state, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez very violent, you know, almost violently opposed Amazon coming to New York City a couple of years ago to set up its East Coast headquarters. And she was angry that they were going to receive about $3 billion over 20 years in tax abatements. And after they pulled out because of opposition, she said, well, now we can use that $3 billion for schools or social programs. But that $3 billion never existed. It was just an abatement on taxes that Amazon would have paid on wealth that they created by coming to New York and paying people high salaries and so forth. So this is the kind of inverted, like you said, demented thinking that animates the left.
When we come back, I want to dive more deeply into all this, and I want to ask Seth Baron the simple question, is this why people come to New York? Don't they come for opportunity instead of for wealth redistribution? We'll be right back. Things were a little hairy at the D'Souza house during the COVID lockdown, and guess what saved us? Omaha Steaks. Now, Debbie likes to do her cooking simple and easy. She enjoys cooking meals on the slow cooker. Now, these Omaha Steak dinners are delicious, and I say this as a foodie who's not really all that easily convinced. I have so many slow cooker favorites, the beef stroganoff, the fully cooked pot roast, chicken and dumplings, jambalaya. It's making me hungry right now. Go to omahasteaks.com, type Dinesh in the search bar, and order Dad the Get Out and Grill assortment. Now, right now, this package is 59% off and includes 20 entrees he's guaranteed to love, like ultra-juicy burgers, plump chicken breasts, sides, desserts, and four 10-ounce butcher-cut New York strips. Now, these strips are aged for 30 days, and why is that important? Because age equals tenderness. Plus, get four free New York strip burgers with your order. It's selling out fast, so you don't want to wait and miss out. Omaha Steaks isn't just steak. It's the best steak of your life. Take it from me. We love these Omaha Steaks so much, we approached them about advertising with us. Visit omahasteaks.com, keyword Dinesh, and get Dad the Get Out and Grill assortment. Plus, four free New York strip burgers and 59% off today. Send Dad more than just a gift. Send him an experience he'll love and can share with you. I'm back with Seth Baron, the managing editor of The American Mind, which is put out by the Claremont Institute, author of the book The Last Days of New York. Seth, you've been talking about the way in which de Blasio and the left, the bureaucracy of the left, have been trying to almost remake New York in the image of some kind of egalitarian society. But that's not why people have admired New York or come to New York. They're attracted by the notion of wealth creation, of opportunity. I remember when I was 17, coming from India as an exchange student, my first sight of America was New York, the New York skyline, the Statue of Liberty. To me, it embodied not just economic opportunity, but the chance to do something with my life that I would not be able to do back home, you may say, in India. So you have been talking about the ways in which New York is now losing that, it seems. And my question is New York losing it forever? Or do you think that there is the possibility of some sort of comeback, just as we saw before with Giuliani? Or is New York too far gone?
Well, that's a great question, and I'm so glad you brought up the idea of opportunity, because I actually talk about this specifically in my book. I mean, yes, New York City has a fair amount of inequality of wealth, but that's not a bad thing. The very rich here pay far more in taxes than they get, you know, as a proportion of their income. And that's what pays for all the social services that the left likes. But the thing is, part of the reason for the inequality is 40% of New York City was born in other countries. Those people come here presumably with very little or nothing, and they come here for opportunity, not for equality. Nobody's coming to New York because they're like, oh, I heard you can get free lunch, you know, at the schools. They come here because they're like, oh, there's a lot of opportunity to work hard and make money, and my good schools, my kids can go to school and do better. So
I mean, one of the things that I remember just from living in New York is everybody's running a kind of a hustle, right? In other words, a limo driver pulls up. He's like, are you heading this way? I'll take you 10 blocks. It'll be $30. So there's the sense that people are on the make. And that always struck me as part of the dynamic capitalism of New York, the fact that this was part of the energy that made the city what it is. And it would be a real pity if that entrepreneurial spirit, those animal spirits themselves, were somehow quenched.
Well, yes, and the left is doing everything they can to squelch it by imposing, you know, okay, paid sick leave on very small employers. Well, look, obviously, we don't want people to have to go to work if they're sick. But at the same time, this is just a burden that the left is placing on small businesses. It's not like the leftists or the government itself is taking on this problem of accounting for people's days and paying an extra week's salary to people so they can be sick at home. So there's this constant outsourcing of responsibility to entrepreneurs and businessmen. Yes, they want to unionize every gig worker. They want to impose rules on every kind of transaction. So absolutely. And well, can New York come back from this? That's a great question. Right now, we're seeing a lot of rich people are leaving the city. Big hedge funds are leaving the city. You know, in the 70s, New York City was unquestionably still the center of finance, media, and, you know, other major industries. So, but now a lot of those things, they don't have to stay in New York. And I don't think the leftists have quite got that New York's not as indispensable as it was. Now, at the same time, there are people, young people seem to be moving into the city as they always do. You know, so maybe they'll provide some kind of new, you know, they'll bring their animal spirits. But it's unclear if New York can't get safe streets and orderly subways and so forth, that it's going to be a stretch.
Now, Cuomo, of course, the governor of the state, who has had his problems and is having problems on the Me Too count. He's having problems on the nursing home scandal count. He's had some public quarrels with de Blasio. Does that reflect just personality quirks between the two? Or is there an ideological difference? Is Cuomo acting as any kind of a check on de Blasio? Or are these basically two dirty, rotten scoundrels who don't get along, but are ultimately yanking the state down both in their own way?
Mostly it's the latter. For some reason, the two of them just hate, Cuomo hates de Blasio. And, you know, they worked together in the Clinton administration and they just have, there's just bad blood. But, you know, this is like a function of having a one party state where, you know, there's basically everything's just run by the Democrats. So these weird, you know, internecine struggles become magnified and dominate politics because they can't, there's no opposition really to provide an effective counterweight, which is, you know, another reason why New York is just lurching to the left, because they keep, since you don't have to run for a general election, really, the primary is the main deciding, you know, election. They just keep leapfrogging each other to the left to try to stand out, and then they don't have to come back to the center because the general election is pretty much irrelevant.
Now, Seth, you're describing a pattern that's not exclusive to New York. We see this in a number of Democratic cities. And by the way, this sort of capsizing seems to be going on with San Francisco. Other cities, which were once great cities, are now also heading in the same direction. So my question is, number one, is this a Democratic city pattern nationwide? And number two, can one point to a Republican city and say, well, you know what? Here's a city that's run by the other party that happens to be doing much better on these indices of entrepreneurship and safety and education and crime and so on. Or do you just have Democratic cities across the board and this is just what's going to happen if you want to live in an American city?
Well, I think your question kind of answers itself. Certainly Democratic cities across the country, like all of them virtually, you know, Philadelphia, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Seattle, Portland, Detroit, Chicago, New York, Baltimore, they're all facing the same issues. In regard to a city that, you know, might be amenable, I don't know, Miami. I don't even know if the mayor of Miami is, I'm not sure what his party is, but he seems like he's open to, you know, business, entrepreneurship. He, you know, they're certainly not in letting BLM take over the streets. And they, you know, they seem to have the right message on crime. I'm not sure about Houston. I heard that Plano, Texas, the suburb of Dallas, used to be the most conservative city in the country, and they just elected a Democrat city council. So, you know, I'm thinking maybe, like, you know, some small town in West Virginia might be the best place to go. I don't know. I'm not particularly hopeful.
It's really tragic. I mean, going all the way back to Aristotle, he thinks of civilized life as occurring in the city. And so this notion of the city as the center of cosmopolitan life, intellectual life, cultural life, good restaurants, it just seems an American tragedy is unfolding in front of our eyes. And it's a pity that this ideological movement has taken what cities have stood for, which is opportunity, mobility, the ability to come up the ladder, and are destroying it in the name of a perverse ideology.
You said it exactly. I mean, at this point, I mean, Bombay may be a better, you know, repository of those kind of like entrepreneurial values than New York City. I mean, I've been to Bombay. It's pretty harried and messy, but there does seem to be, like, you know, people are hustling. Let's put it that way.
That's for sure. Hey, Seth Baron, thanks for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely, Dinesh. Thank you.
If you listen to my podcast, you know how much I'm against big tech censorship. We have to walk on eggshells and be careful what we say and how we say it because we know whose side they are on. So instead of letting big tech cancel your right to free speech, how about canceling their access to your private data? That's why I use ExpressVPN. Have you ever wondered how huge tech sites make money when they're actually free to use? Well, they do it by tracking your searches, your video history, and everything you click on, and then selling your valuable data to third parties. When you use ExpressVPN, your device's IP address gets masked. This helps anonymize your online activity, making it much more difficult to trace and sell to advertisers. ExpressVPN also encrypts 100% of your network data to protect you from cyber criminals and hackers. What I love most about ExpressVPN is that it does all of these things with just one tap of a button. It couldn't be easier to use. You just fire up the app on any of your devices, hit connect, and you're protected. It's time to say no to censorship and take back your online privacy at expressvpn.com/Dinesh. Visit this link and you'll get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN service for free. That's expressvpn.com/Dinesh to protect your data today. I want to talk about miracles. Have you ever seen or witnessed a miracle? I haven't. But I know many people who have. They believe firmly that they have experienced a miracle in their lives, or they have been present and seen a healing, some kind of event that they would describe honestly as miraculous. There is no way this otherwise could have happened. They don't just mean it was an unlikely event. They mean it was a supernatural event. Now, the question I want to explore is whether miracles are invalidated, are made impossible by the fact that we live in a world that is determined, and I'm using that term also in its philosophical sense, determined by physical scientific laws. Now, the most famous argument against miracles was given by the philosopher David Hume, and I'll come to that in a minute, because Hume is kind of the guru of today's kind of new atheist, the atheist camp represented by people like Hitchens and Richard Dawkins. Here's Richard Dawkins talking about miracles. And Richard Dawkins is responding to biologist Stephen Jay Gould. By the way, Stephen Jay Gould had tried to make a sort of rapprochement, a healing between the scientific and the religious communities by saying, listen, the scientific and the religious communities are doing two different things. The scientific community pursues facts, and the religious community pursues values. And since facts and values belong to sort of two conceptually different camps, you can allow each group to kind of do its own thing. There's no reason they should be clashing or fighting with each other. This is the theme of Stephen Jay Gould's book called Rocks of Ages. Now, Dawkins, I think, very slyly notices that this doesn't really work. And Dawkins says, well, what about miracles? He goes, miracles are actually a claim, not just about values. You should be honest and truthful. Miracles are claims that some event occurred. This dead guy came back to life. This person with cancer was miraculously cured. And so, says Dawkins, there is now an overlap because somebody is claiming that this was done miraculously or supernaturally, and science, he says, shows that that cannot happen. Why? Because, says Dawkins, quote, science is based upon verifiable evidence. And miracles, according to him, are violations of the incorrigible, unalterable laws of science. Now, let's turn from Dawkins to someone who makes this argument in a more formal and sophisticated way, and that is the philosopher David Hume. I'm now going to sort of outline Hume's argument, and then I'm going to outline my refutation of it. Here's Hume's argument in four parts. Number one, a miracle is a violation of the known laws of nature. Number two, we know these laws through repeated and constant experience. Number three, the testimony of those who report a miracle or claim to have seen a miracle contradicts the operation of known scientific laws. Therefore, number four, no one can rationally believe in miracles. Basically, what Hume is saying is that someone says there's a miracle, even if they're a believable guy, not, you know, habitually given to lying, you have to weigh the credibility of their testimony against the fact that we have literally millions upon millions of experiences that say the opposite. So a guy goes, I miraculously saw a guy with three eyes. You go, wait a minute. We've seen millions and millions of people all over the world, and everybody has two eyes. So are we going to believe this guy who says that he saw a man with three eyes? So are we going to believe the accumulated weight of human experience as consolidated in the form of scientific laws that say that Homo sapiens, human beings, are born with two eyes? So this appears to be a kind of devastating argument against miracles, so devastating that many Christians have sort of cowered from it and run for cover. Here's the theologian Rudolf Bultmann now writing about a generation ago in the early 1960s. Bultmann goes, well, it is impossible to use electric lights and the wireless and to avail ourselves of modern medical and surgical discoveries and at the same time to believe in the New Testament world of spirits and miracles. So Bultmann is willing to give them up and basically say, well, maybe we should subtract miracles from Christianity. But I think we all know that you can't do that. Why? Because Christianity of all religions is actually dependent on miracles. It's the religion that relies the most on miracles, even more than Judaism. By the way, there are miracles in the Old Testament, but if you remove the miracles, the Old Testament would largely remain the same. The Jewish religion, Jewish faith, is not critically dependent on miracles, but Christianity is. Why? Because Christianity rises or falls on the resurrection. A miracle, a supernatural event. A man who was put to death by the Romans rose again. And of course, Jesus, as we know, performed a whole bunch of miracles. He brought the sick to life, and he made people who were lame walk, and he cured leprosy, and he did all this stuff. Even Islam, compared to Christianity, hardly depends on miracles. I believe in the Quran at some place Muhammad is associated with a single miracle, but just one. Again, if you remove the miracle, Islam remains largely the same. So let's now come back to David Hume's argument, because it seems so unassailable, and I want to just outline my refutation of it, which I will develop in the next segment. Here's my refutation. A miracle is a violation of the known laws of nature. This, my first point, repeats David Hume's first point. The second point, scientific laws are, on Hume's own account, empirically unverifiable. What I'm saying here is critical. What I'm saying is that Hume forgot to read his own book. Hume's argument against miracles, by the way, is contained in a book called An Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding. But in another book by Hume called A Treatise on Human Nature, Hume himself explains why no scientific law is empirically verifiable and claims that, in fact, science has laws are themselves absurd. Now, it's important to distinguish here between two types of laws. I would call them mathematical laws on the one hand and empirical laws on the other. No one denies that mathematical laws operate by necessity. So 2 + 2 = 4. That will always be true. That is true by necessity. Pythagoras' theorem, that if you add the square in a right triangle, if you add the squares of the two sides, it equals the square of the long side. That's the Pythagorean theorem. It's always true. It's true by necessity. But let's take a different kind of empirical law. Light travels at a known speed, or E equals mc squared, or Newton's square law. I'm going to show in the next segment that those laws, empirical laws, are not empirically verifiable. So here we go. Scientific laws are, on Hume's own account, empirically unverifiable. Thus, violations of the known laws of nature are possible. If these laws are unverifiable, obviously there could be exceptions to those laws, and therefore miracles are possible. The bottom line of it is there are some people who think that miracles are like old-fashioned. This is, you know, people in the old days used to believe all kinds of stupid stuff. But as C.S. Lewis himself points out in the book called Miracles, Lewis says, hey, listen, don't think that ancient people were all that stupid. Ancient people knew that dead people don't come back to life. Ancient people knew how babies were made. They didn't think that, for example, you could be born of a virgin. So when these things happen in the ancient world, don't think the ancient people go, well, it could be the case. No, they knew that this was a scandalous departure from the normal patterns of nature. A miracle is a very irregular event. Even believers affirm that there is a pattern in nature, but there can be exceptions to it if God wills that there should be. That's the definition of a miracle, and as I'm about to show, such miracles are in no way inconsistent with any known laws of nature. Hey, are you taking part in the Dinesh book and movie giveaway yet? This is my attempt to really help us all support Mike Lindell, a really courageous guy, but a guy who also makes fantastic products. So if you spend $250 or $500 or $1,000, you're going to get a free book or two free books and two free movies or the mini Dinesh D'Souza book and movie collection. Now, I want to talk about one of Mike's products, and this is his amazing Giza Dream bed sheets. Mike found the best cotton in the world in a place where the Sahara Desert, the Nile River, and the Mediterranean Sea all come together to create the ideal weather conditions for growing cotton. His new Giza Dream bedsheets are made with this long staple cotton, and Mike guarantees, and I guarantee, they'll be the most comfortable sheets you ever own. The first night you sleep on them, you'll never want to sleep on anything else. Now, these Giza Dream sheets are available in a variety of colors, like all of Mike's products, 60-day money-back guarantee, 10-year warranty. So right now, buy one, get one free by calling 800-876-0227 and use promo code Dinesh. For a limited time, again, buy one, get one free, call 800-876-0227 or go to mypillow.com. Make sure to use promo code Dinesh. I'm discussing whether miracles are possible, and I'm doing it by looking at David Hume's famous argument that denies miracles on the grounds that miracles are violations of what he calls the laws of nature. Now, I think he has to amend that slightly to say the known laws of nature, because obviously if we don't know what the laws of nature are, we can't distinguish events that violate those laws from events that don't. Now, my question is, what are these known laws of nature? I mean, no one denies that there are patterns in nature. In fact, Christian believers agree that there are these patterns. In fact, you need the patterns in order to have miracles. If you didn't have a pattern, for example, that sick people generally can't be cured by someone waving their hand, the miracle, by definition, is a rare event that departs from a pattern. That's what inspires wonder. That's what makes it, quote, miraculous. us. So there's an agreement between both sides that a miracle is an extremely rare and unlikely event. But the question is, can such unlikely events even occur in the first place? And Hume seems to be saying no, on the basis of the fact that you've got these verifiable laws that miracles supposedly contradict. And my point is that there are no laws, no empirical laws that are verifiable in this sense, and that the proof of this, amazingly enough, is given by Hume himself. Here's what Hume says, and this is from his book, A Treatise of Human Nature. He says, "From no amount of empirical observations, however large, can you derive a law, a general law, that is true as a matter of logic." And we need to think about this for a minute. From no amount of repetitions, experiments, observations, however big, can you make a general law that is necessarily true, that's true as a matter of logic. Let's see why Hume is correct about this. Let's take, for example, the speed of light, which is a known speed. We don't need to go into what it is. It's 186,000 miles a second in a vacuum. Let's just call it speed c. Now, how do we know the speed of light? Well, we measure it, but doesn't matter how often you measure it. How do you know that on a star, let's say 100 light years away, that over there, light travels at this speed? You don't know. No one knows. Why? Because we can't go there and measure it. So the simple truth of it is we're assuming that because light over here, measured by many experiments, travels at a known speed, it must travel at that speed everywhere in the universe. This is not something we're in a position to verify at all. Throughout Western history, there have been propositions made based on observation. Let me take a very famous one from the field of philosophy. This is what is known as the example of white swans. Now, for thousands of years in Western civilization, every observed swan was white. Literally, people saw tens of millions of swans, and they were all white. And therefore, the phrase, as white as a swan, became very common in Western literature, in Western poetry. One would say that it was a law of nature that all swans are white. But then the white man for the first time set foot on the shores of Australia and saw for the first time a black swan. So how many black swans does it take to invalidate the rule that all swans are white? Only one. One is sufficient. And suddenly it became known that despite this kind of incalculable amount of empirical verification, the simple truth is all swans are not white. And the law that all swans are white is simply not a law at all. It was merely repeated observation. Now, this is a very key point because what Hume is saying is that this is true of all laws, all empirical laws. Let's take an example that makes Hume's point really clear. Let's take a child who's bouncing a ball, and the child is kind of surprised because the first time he drops the ball comes back up, boom, it bounced. What? So the child looks at the adult who's sitting on the armchair and says, sort of, what's going on here? Now, the adult gives an explanation of what's going on. Oh, son, let me explain it to you. You know, a ball has a certain kind of quality that we call, you know, its ability to bounce. A ball has a certain kind of shape that causes it to bounce. So the adult gives a certain explanation, but Hume asks kind of a deep question, which is, putting aside this explanation, which is essentially a bunch of gobbledygook, Hume says, what experience has the adult had that the child has not had? How does the adult, quote, know better? Know better based on what? And Hume says, well, the adult has basically seen a lot of balls bounce. I see a ball, I drop it, it bounces. I see another ball, I drop it, it bounces. And I conclude from this repetition, which Hume calls custom, I'm accustomed to seeing balls bounce, that all balls must bounce in this way. But Hume says, there is no logical reason to go from my repeated experience, just like with the swans. Every swan I've seen is white, therefore when I get to Australia and see a swan, it must be white. Wrong. And Hume says, just because you've seen something happen one or two or even a million times doesn't mean it has to happen that way the next time. Now, this is the key point. Now, you might say, wait a minute, Hume, you're absolutely wrong about that because of the scientific principle of causality. Doesn't causality establish a necessary connection between a cause and an effect? But this is Hume's exact point. No, it doesn't. Causality is simply a word that signals repetition. Causality simply means I've seen it happen once and twice and many times, and therefore I expect, Hume says due to custom and not due to logic that it will happen that way again. Now, what about the idea that scientific laws are obviously valid because they work? Because they've been proven to work. Hey, Dinesh, you know, airplanes fly and Voyagers go to Mars, and obviously there must be fixed scientific laws, otherwise this stuff would all fall to the ground. Wrong. Why wrong? My example has to do with Isaac Newton. All these things from sending rockets to the moon are based upon Newtonian physics. The whole Industrial Revolution was based on Newtonian physics. Newtonian physics obviously worked. And yet, we now know from Einstein's theories of relativity, Newton was not entirely correct. Newton's laws needed to be amended in important ways. Newtonian physics was superseded by Einsteinian physics. And therefore, despite the fact that you had an unimaginable, incalculable amount of empirical confirmation, we now know in retrospect that Newton's theories were inadequate. They really weren't nature's laws. They were Newton's laws. And that's the key point. All scientific laws are basically observations based on previous tries. Now, true, you can try to refute a law by pointing to an exception, but that doesn't mean you get an empirically unfalsifiable proposition. All you get are more falsifiable propositions. And so scientific knowledge, this is an observation by the philosopher Karl Popper, are always provisional, always open to being revised. And the same is true of Einstein's laws. One day, and I don't think this day is that far off, we will see modifications, improvements, refinements even of Einstein's theories of relativity. Here's the bottom line. When we speak of scientific laws, we're not talking about necessary truths. We're simply talking about observational truths based upon previous observations and previous experiments. And that is all we can say about these scientific laws. And if that's all we can say, then it obviously follows that miracles, which are essentially not violations of the laws of nature, but violations of the observed laws that we happen to know. My point is, we don't know the laws of nature. What we have are observations based upon experiments and based upon previous empirical experience. And that's all we have. And in that world of limited human knowledge and limited scientific knowledge, there is nothing to say that miracles are impossible.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify, or watch on Rumble, YouTube, and SalemNow.com.